We have everybody here. Let's go. It's 10:15. Let's go back on the record. I've just been informed that we do not need to go into confidential session by Ms. Good. Ms. Sorensen, I remind you, you are under oath. Ms. Good, your mental redirect. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Burbridge. We are not going to belabor the point, and Precor is going to rest our case with this witness anyway.
Wow. Very good. Thank you. You're excused, Ms. Sorensen. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Then with that, I obviously we're not going to call Mr. Hedrick, so...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're not resting our case completely. We're done with that witness. I'm sorry. You were so excited. Moving it along.
Sorry, guys.
I'm sorry.
If you would raise your right hand, please. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, subject to penalty of perjury? Thank you. You're a witness, Ms. Good.
Good morning, Mr. Hedrick. Could you please state your name for the record?
My name is David W. Hedrick.
And where are you employed?
I'm employed with Guernsey & Company.
What is your position at?
I am the Executive Vice President and the Manager of the Analytical Solutions Group.
Mr. Hedrick, a question that I think we all know the answer to. Have you testified before this commission before?
Yes.
Did you file direct testimony in this matter?
I did.
For the record, your direct testimony is marked as Exhibit 1.1. Is that correct, Mr. Hedrick?
I believe that's correct.
And the attachments are marked Exhibits 1.2A-1 through 1.2T?
I believe that's correct.
Did you also file rebuttal testimony in this matter?
I did.
And your rebuttal testimony, for the record, is marked Exhibit 3. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. Yes.
And the attachments are marked Exhibits 3.1 through 3.2?
Yes.
Mr. Hedrick, are there any changes or updates to your testimony or exhibits?
There was an update. We filed a revised version of Schedule A1, which was required, which was to be in compliance with the rate filing for the COPA to be applied for 2017. That particular schedule also addressed the issue that commission staff raised with regard to the Black Hills power cost and kilowatt hours being excluded. And I believe that's attachment one, version two. I'm not sure what, I think it's been filed, but I don't know that, I know exactly what exhibit it is.
Let's go ahead and look so that that's clear. Please turn to exhibit 1.2, and then it's marked as A-1. 1.2A-1, 2017 version. And at the top, it says Exhibit A-1, Revised Version 2. And the base number on that is Powder River Energy Corporation 000017. Is that the correct and revised version that you were referring to, Mr. Hedrick?
Yes, that's correct.
With that, please summarize your testimony.
I'll try and be brief. My direct testimony was a discussion simply of the COPA filing, the mechanics of the COPA filing, the purpose of the filing, the mid-year filing, to recover the change in power cost from Basin, and a discussion of the schedules and the calculation, typically what we include with the COPA filing. My rebuttal testimony included a discussion of the areas where Powder River disagreed with Mr. Higgins' assertions in his testimony, particularly with regard to, one, the commodity. You know, what's the definition of the commodity price? What are we looking at? And For Powder River, they indicated that their understanding of what we're talking about is the rates paid to basin and wholesale power cost. And the reason for that is historically that's been the definition of what the commodity price has represented in terms of these COPA filings. I've been involved in every one of the COPA filings since it's since we began these back in 2001. And the purpose of the COPA mechanism was to ensure that Powder River had an ability to pass through whatever changes in wholesale power costs occurred from basin. In the early years, we weren't really that concerned about increases. We were actually looking for ways to ensure that we were passing back the reductions in cost. But throughout that time period history, there's never been a discussion like this in terms of delving into the components of power cost. And so our understanding of what commodity price is, I think, is based on our experience with the application of the rule. With all due respect to the commission and the previous commissions as well, a almost hands-off to the non-jurisdictional component of the power cost in terms of looking at the different components. So the other components of Mr. Higgins' testimony that we disagreed with was the assertion that you could craft a component of this change that was attributable to any one particular factor based on information that was provided in member notices and press releases. I think the testimony that's been provided previously indicated that, and I assert this as well, that without looking at all of the components individually, you can really tell a distorted story in terms of what is impacted and what the impacts are of a particular item. Also included in my rebuttal testimony, concerns with regard to Mr. Higgins' assertion that you could carve out a piece of this and just simply not apply it to the joint intervener's clients. In terms of fair and equitable treatment, we certainly don't believe that that's true. There's no provision for how those costs would be recovered. Ostensibly, if we still had to pay them, they'd be recovered by everyone else on the system. So it's certainly not fair and equitable. And I think that's the main components of my rebuttal testimony. There were other items in there that we also addressed as well. But I think that's a fairly short, quick summary of my testimony.
I will pass the witness for cross-examination, Mr. Burbridge.
Thank you, Ms. Goldberg. Mr. Gifford, are you doing cross-examination?
Yes, I am. Thus far been the silent member of this trio over here, but we'll hopefully spring briefly to life. Good morning, Mr. Hedrick.
Good morning.
I will again try and be brief and also repeat the admonition that we had talked about earlier, that I may be delving into confidential information. If you would keep me honest, I'm sure Ms. Good will keep me honest, maybe kick Mr. Roselli, who will then kick me if I delve into something improper. But let's try and take it slow and obviously not make any mistakes for either of us. You would agree with Basin that DGC is a non-electric subsidiary.
I think they classify it as a non-electric subsidiary. I think the confusion that's been raised is that it's somehow not related.
DGC doesn't generate any electricity.
In and of itself, DGC doesn't, as far as I understand, doesn't.
You would agree with me that our clients, joint interveners, and in fact, all customers of Precor don't have a choice with regard to who, where they get their electricity.
That's correct.
And they don't have a choice to who the wholesale electricity provider is. Is that correct?
That's correct.
They would properly be called captive ratepayers. Is that a reasonable description?
It is a description that you use, yes.
But you've heard the term captive ratepayers before.
Certainly.
And you understand that one of the purposes of regulatory proceedings is to protect those captive ratepayers.
It's to protect the interests of all the stakeholders, yes.
Certainly, but one of the concerns that regulation has is that captive ratepayers are not exploited by a monopoly provider. Would you agree with that as a matter of general regulatory principle?
General regulatory principle, yes. And again, co-ops are somewhat different than investor-owned because the alignment of interests are different. Stakeholders and ratepayers they're the same folks, and they're represented democratically on board of directors. So it is decidedly different than an IOU situation.
But joint interveners don't have anybody on the board of directors of Precor, do they?
They don't, but that doesn't mean they're not represented.
They don't. You just talked about cooperatives and investor-owned utilities. I see from your testimony, Mr. Hedrick, you have testified in front of the Arizona Corporation Commission, the Arkansas Public Service Commission, the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, the Texas PUC, and of course here in Wyoming. Were all those cases involving cooperatives, or do some of them involve investor-owned utilities?
They all involve cooperatives.
So you wouldn't know how an investor-owned utility is regulated when it has an unregulated subsidiary.
I haven't been involved in a proceeding with an IOU.
So you haven't seen a situation involving an IOU where the IOU has an unregulated subsidiary?
I have not been involved in a case with an IOU, no.
So you wouldn't know how, for instance, the NARUC electricity cost allocation manual directs regulators to treat an unregulated subsidiary?
I'm not familiar with that, no.
You wouldn't know how the NARUC rate case and audit manual directs commissions to treat regulated and unregulated subsidiaries involved in investment.
I've not been involved in that.
And you wouldn't know how FERC affiliate restrictions work involving a company that has a regulated and an unregulated subsidiary.
I'm not familiar with those, no.
Have you ever heard the term ring fencing?
I have not.
Thank you. Just a few questions specifically about your testimony now, Mr. Hedrick, and believe it or not, before Chairman Muneer moves on to the other team in the Super Bowl, I hope we can get done here in about 10 minutes. The Patriots are a much more complex subject. So, on page 2 of your rebuttal testimony, you talk about the scope of the commission's inquiry. Do you see that in line 13 to 17?
On page 2?
Correct. I'll let you get there.
Yes.
You're counseling the commission to evaluate whether a pass-on is a commodity or commodity-related cost. They should look at whether it's a commodity cost to Precor, not at the components of the wholesale power cost billed by Basin. Is that, I read that correctly?
That's correct.
So you're saying that the commission should not look at what the components of any bill from Basin involve? Is that correct?
And as I indicated in my summary, my understanding, and again, representing Powder River's understanding of the commission's, you know, review is based on our experience. Our experience has been that the commission, not just this commission, but previous commissions and previous commissions before that, have not delved into the components of the wholesale cost as provided by a third party. Again, our review of the rule indicates that they're commodity costs that are non-jurisdictional to the commission. And so not just in COPA cases is that true, but even in rate cases, that's been true. Even in pass-on applications by other distribution co-ops when they were rate regulated, was that true? There's not been a look at components of, say, Tri-State or Mean or Basin. So that's the basis for the statement is, with regard to being consistent with the application of the rule as it has been made to Powder River through the years, you would look at the commodity cost from Basin.
So, as I'm not asking you,
Powder River.
So, and not asking you for a legal conclusion, but I understand what you're talking about is practice. Is that correct? Past practice?
Yes, and I was trying not to make a legal, you know, whether the commission chooses to do that is totally up to the commission. It would mark a change.
So has the commission ever seen a mid-year COPA increase of this magnitude?
I don't know of this magnitude. I think we have had a mid-year change before, but I don't know of this magnitude.
And would it seem reasonable that customers who are experiencing a mid-year rate increase of this magnitude might want to do something about that or have somebody take a look at that?
Well, again, I'm not sure whether the fact that it's a mid-year change has any relevance in terms of, I mean, it's a large increase. I certainly believe that members will ask questions and want information. I think the testimony over the last day and a half has shown pretty clearly that Basin is pretty transparent in terms of their willingness to provide information. I've been doing this a long time, and I'm not aware of another time in this commission, at least in my experience with the commission, where a non-jurisdictional utility, you know, provided all of the information that's been provided.
So let me see if we maybe agree here. You're not counseling the commission not to look at the components of this wholesale power increase?
I think it's a dilemma for the commission. And again, it's the rules, I think, have been interpreted the way they have been because there's clearly an indication that they're non-jurisdictional. But that's a question for the commission to answer. I'm not counseling them on a legal interpretation.
So would you agree or disagree that this commission can look into whether costs passed along to cover rate increases or losses rather at DGC are prudently and properly included in a commodity cost passed along?
My understanding, the commission's got to be satisfied that the wholesale costs that are incurred by Powder River are prudent. To the extent that that's been done historically has been that the contract that Powder River has entered into knowingly and willingly and provides the appropriate benefits, as we've talked about. It has not gone into a deep delve of the different individual components of wholesale power costs, whether it's Basin or whether it's Tri-State or whether it's some other entity. So singling out a particular component at a particular wholesale provider, I don't believe that it gives the entire picture of whether something is prudent or not. And I think there's been, fortunately, in this particular case, I think there's been a great deal of evidence to support that DGC is prudent. But
and DGC,
being that besides that, I think the bigger picture is, you know, what's the commission's role in determining what's prudent? In the, you know, for the past 15 years, Basin's wholesale power cost has been deemed prudent, and it includes DGC. And so I agree, there's a dilemma in terms of where the line gets drawn, but I think that's the fundamental question, not whether DGC specifically is a proceeding to determine that is far more than what we've done today in terms of.
Understood. So let's go to DGC. Its place in the Basin pantheon, if you will. DGC is lost money in 2016. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, that they have losses. They do reflect losses, yes.
And DGC is projected to lose money in 2017.
That's my understanding.
And DGC is projected to lose money in 2018.
Again, that's my understanding.
And DGC is projected to lose money in 2019.
I believe that's correct.
And DGC is expected to lose money in 2020.
I believe that's correct, yes.
And in 2021, DGC, according to Basin, will return to profitability.
I believe that's correct.
And that, of course, is a projection.
It is a projection. I think what's left out of that discussion is that for the last 20 years or so, there have been, profits from DGC, if I understand correctly. So, you know, we're looking at a particular short window for that particular venture, and have focused entirely on that without, at least I believe the interveners have focused entirely on that without looking at the previous benefits.
But previous benefits, even if they were benefits, are benefits that have been realized and are in the past, correct?
They are realized and have been in the past and have benefited the members of the co-op, yes.
And what matters to an economic actor, any economic actor, is what happens going forward, is that correct?
Well, I believe they're certainly we're interested in what's going to happen in the future, but the evaluation of whether a particular venture has been successful or not is not driven by the results of a year.
Fair enough. Now Mr. Hedrick, let's assume something. You and I are investors, which would be somewhat laughable, at least in my case. And in 1990, we buy the stock in Blockbuster Lease, a great new service. You with me?
So far.
And you and I hold, we're joint investors, this stock till 2003. And because Blockbuster Video has been fabulous, it has given us a number of benefits. Is that correct?
It would have at least. For a period, it would have, yes.
And in 2004, all of a sudden, this new thing, Netflix, comes along. And we start losing. Is that plausible to you as a historical matter?
I believe that is exactly what happened.
Would you advise even with hindsight or foresight in 2003, that we look back at our benefits or look forward to our expected returns?
Well, I would certainly be interested in what I have earned from that historically as a context of what's coming in the future. Now, again, if there was no sense that, you know, going forward in your projections, there are 2 or 3 or 4 years where it's projected that there'll be losses. It's also projected that it will return to profitability in the future. I don't believe your example, that probably would have been the case. So but I think you do take it into consideration when you're looking forward with respect to what's the, you know, do we expect this to turn around? Is this going to be something that we can continue to rely on in the future?
Would you agree with me, Mr. Hedrick, that projections can change?
Certainly.
And projections can change fairly quickly. Would you agree with that?
Certainly.
In fact, and I don't need you to talk about the numbers, and I don't need to mention the numbers, but I would draw your attention, and it's good if you want these numbers on the record, we can go into a confidential session, but I'd just like you to take a look at a couple numbers. If you could go, Mr. Hedrick, to Exhibit 234.6.
Is this joint interveners?
Joint interveners to page 9 and 15.
Is it J-I?
J-I-O-1-1-O.
1-1-O.
And I don't need you to say the numbers, but I'd just like you to look at that, Mr. Hedrick. And for the record, I will represent to you that the cover page of this exhibit is a June Basin Electric Power Cooperative agenda and documents. Do you see that number there?
I see the graphic, yes.
The budgeted loss and the projected end of year estimate loss.
Yes.
Now I'd like you, Mr. Hedrick, to go to Exhibit 234.3 and to JI0053. Are you there?
I am there.
And I'll represent for the record, this is a September 13th Basin Electric Power Cooperative agenda and documents. Would you agree with that?
I have no reason to that.
So this is essentially 2 months after the last exhibit we looked at. Is that correct?
I believe so, based on the dates.
And on that JI0053, if you look at that chart, does it look familiar?
The charts look like the same charts with different numbers, yes.
Yes, and the numbers changed in 2 months. Is that correct?
And apparently they did, yes.
So that projection in 2 months changed. I won't characterize it dramatically or not, but that
they changed, certainly.
We're in the home stretch, at least from my end, Mr. Hedrick. I would like you to go to page 7 and 8 of your rebuttal testimony, if you would. Are you there?
I am there.
And I'll direct you to the bottom of page 7, and here you are. I think I'm characterizing it quite plainly. You're rebutting Mr. Higgins' assertion that 62% of the basin increase is attributable to DGC losses. Do you see that?
I do.
And you are criticizing Mr. Higgins here for not fully taking into account the other stated reasons for the rate increase. Is that correct?
In part, yes.
And those other four aspects are lower than indicated member sales, reduced revenue from non-member sales, added costs to operate generation facilities, and generation and transmission investments. Is that right?
And then the reduced revenue support from the non-electric.
Right, yes. Right. So, but those are the four
yes.
components where you're saying that Mr. Higgins got it wrong.
I'm saying that Mr. Higgins looked at one particular component and crafted or took numbers from presentations to come up with a percentage that he asserts as being the percentage of the total increase of that one particular item.
Did you do your own analysis for what each component of the rate increase constituted?
I did not. My testimony effectively, and the example I give, which I don't believe is any more valid than Mr. Higgins' approach, is to simply look at one particular item and craft a percentage.
And in fact, what you say later on there on page 8 is purporting to use Mr. Higgins' methodology that you can derive 80% of the total increase from decreased sales. Is that right?
Yes, and simply put, that means taking the information from the slide and crafting it as a percentage of the total without looking at any of the other components.
Well, let's quickly run through your analysis there and make sure we're on the same page. You say that the budget variance for reduced sales is $92.2 million. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
You have not included any avoided costs associated with providing less power to members in that calculation, have you?
I have not.
But you would agree that there is an avoided cost to the out from the reduced sales, is that
certainly
correct?
There would be some reduced variable costs as a result of that.
So it's the revenue variance less the avoided cost to derive that number of from lower than anticipated members.
That would be one way of doing it, yeah.
But you don't take into account the avoided costs.
I have not.
So you don't know and are not representing with this commission how much of this rate increase is attributable to DGC losses.
No. Basically, what I'm saying is that
thank you.
You can't do that.
No further questions, Mr. Burke.
Thank you. Ms. Fish, do you have questions of Mr. Hedrick?
I do.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Hedrick.
Good morning.
I do have a few questions concerning the exhibits you provided with this filing. I would like to start off with the adjustments you made for the Black Hills Electric costs. You did remove $64,000, is that correct?
We removed the $64,000 in Black Hills power costs.
Okay. It's my understanding from looking at Exhibit 1.2B1 that Black Hills Electric is only billed once a year in December. That is base number 19.
Yes.
Would a portion of the December 2016 bill have already been collected between January and July of the last filing?
Portion of the bill have been collected. It just depends what month it hits. And so
so in the last COPA filing, there was a portion, there was a bill in there for Black Hills Electric, correct?
Last COPA fund, there should have been, yes. I would, yeah. So.
And my question is because this is an out of period adjustment, would a portion of the December 2016 bill that is being put in B1, would a portion of that have already been collected between January and July?
Well, I guess the give a broader answer to this question, I think, because to the extent that to the extent that the power cost, as long as it's treated correctly in the reconciliation, it doesn't matter what month it happens, because it'll get trued up. The purpose for the correction to the schedule, and forgive me if I'm retreading something here, but I want to make sure everybody is clear, that in the rate filing, when we calculate the COPA factor, we exclude the Black Hills power cost and the Black Hills kilowatt hour. Historically, in developing the COPA allocation factor up through, I forget which year it is now, but the basin, I keep saying basin, Black Hills power cost just simply wasn't included in the power cost that we used to calculate the COPA. But at some point, it began being included, and therefore, in our calculation of the COPA, it need to comport with what we've done in the rate filing. It specifically needs to be taken out for purposes of calculating the factor. So once we've got the factor calculated, whether the basin or whether Black Hills power cost is billed in November or December or whatever month it is, the reconciliation component of the COPA will ensure that we're recovering the appropriate amount. So I don't know the specifics of when. I think it's always billed in December. I think it is.
Okay. Would you please pull up Commission Exhibit 126? And it will be the attachment to that. Base number PSC 000199. From your adjustment for the Black Hills Electric, you also removed approximately 1 million kilowatt hours from the budget kilowatt hours sold. This table was provided in spreadsheets given to the commission. Can you please tell me where that $1 million is included in this table? Or I'm sorry, 1 million,
1 million kilowatt hours. And good question. So this is the total of all of the kilowatt hours projected for 2017 in that column. So Black Hills kilowatt hours would have been included. They're embedded in that residential in terms of projected. It's not separated out. It's not shown separately as a separate item. So in the calculation of the COPA, we have calculated what we believe the projected component for the Black Hills kilowatt hours are. So within the spreadsheet, we've calculated a million kilowatt hours that would be associated with the Black Hills. It doesn't show up as a separate line item in the projections that are on this particular page, but it would be included in the residential.
Okay. So Black Hills kilowatt hours are typically projected included in the residential?
Included in the residential.
These values are hard-coded. Can you please explain to me how you calculated these projections?
The projections are based on the budget and forecast numbers that Powder River provides. So that's why these are hard numbers. That's a whole process that they go through in terms of their financial forecasting and budgeting process to determine what they believe the kilowatt hours are going to be on a projected period.
So these numbers are provided to you from Precorp?
Certainly, yes.
Can you please turn to Precorp Exhibit 1.2D? Can you please just give me an overview of how you calculate the balancing account?
Yeah, I mean, you've got three different the three different groups that we're talking about, remainder, LPT, and LPCDM, they're basically separate in terms of the application of the COPA. And if you go back to, or it begins with the beginning balance, you know, if you look at the remainder class in the far right-hand column, 162 would be the previous balance from the previous month. The $85,774 over under recovery would have been the amount that we calculated on schedule, whatever it is for October.
It should be
the next page, $85,774. And then the prior true-up in the COPA would be the actual true-up amount that's embedded in the COPA. So then the addition of, you just add those across, and then if it's in October, it's an under recovery, so you only apply interest if it's an over recovery, so there's no interest applied. You add those across, that's the $117,000, then you start the process again.
So I would like to focus on column C that you mentioned, the prior year true up in COPA. Can you explain to me how you calculate that number?
Calculate that number.
That number was also hard coded.
It's the amount that is reflected. So that the application of the COPA factor is two pieces. It's the recovery of wholesale power cost projected, and it's the over or under recovery for the prior period. So when we look at the existing factor, the total factor can be broken into two pieces. So on Powder River's records, they know which portion of it is related to the recovery of power cost and which portion of it is related to prior period recovery. So the hard-coded numbers are simply the calculation of that component of the wholesale COPA that is related to that. So again, it would be data that's provided by Powder River.
Do you think it would be more transparent if those factors were provided with the filing?
The factors provided with the filing.
The factors to calculate this prior year true up, as well as the...
You can certainly provide the information, but it is the actual number. It is actually the actual number that they record. So yes, there's no problem providing any of that information. And I'm hesitating because all of the information is typically provided. So I'm not sure. I want to make sure that we haven't provided it. But if you don't have it, then if it wasn't provided, you don't know where it's at. So we can ensure that you have that.
Thank you. That's all my question.
Thank you. Mr. Gray.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Gifford stole most of my questions, so we'll get to pages 7-8 of your testimony, but I do want to go back and look at that for just a second. Let's go back. So again, we're looking at Exhibit 3, pages 7 and 8. If the commission decides to exercise its jurisdiction under its Rule 26 and look to the COPA filing to identify commodity or commodity-related costs, does the company have a competing number, the joint intervener's number, the one that Mr. Higgins provided, for us to consider as potential exclusion from the COPA?
No, I think the position is that we believe the entire power cost is commodity cost.
In your summary, and I think in your answers to Mr. Gifford in your cross-examination, you relied extensively on past practice as what this commission looks at and what it does in the COPA.
It is.
Is it possible that the reason this hasn't ever come up prior is that there weren't any non commodity-related costs included in the COPA filing?
I don't think that's accurate because the power cost from Basin, what we're talking about in the COPA is changes in the power cost. The power cost from Basin has been subject to, it's been involved, every rate case that we've done has Basin power cost in it. Every previous COPA that we have done has Basin power cost in it. And all of the description of who Basin is in terms of their operations, which has included DGC, haven't changed. It's been the same. So we currently have power costs built into our rates that includes power costs from Basin, that includes DGC and all the other components. So it's been highlighted by the joint interveners as an item to be considered. That's all I can say. That's the only difference. That's the only difference that I can see at this point, because historically it's been there. The costs are there. Basin's always been there. But the questions have never been asked about what are the underlying components that go into this. And so that's the basis for our position in terms of, that's how we've responded in terms of the application.
I'm just trying to understand your historical perspective.
Right. And I get it. And I get the dilemma that you have with this particular issue with regard to where's the line?
Do you recall in your experience with the COPA that Basin has ever specifically identified what I will call a hard loss at DGC as a reason for a rate increase?
I don't recall them giving information to their members indicating that, that this is one of the components that is driving this. And as the witnesses from Basin have indicated, it's a perfect storm in terms of a lot of other things. But no, I don't recall any other time where it was listed as a component.
Yesterday, I think in my discussion with Mr. Easley, I tried to explain the difference in my head right now about embedded costs and benefits versus, I guess the interveners use the word hard, which I guess is better than when I was using hard benefits and hard losses. And we went through Exhibit 2.2 that demonstrated hard benefits that have been provided in the past. Do you recall those discussions?
I do.
Can you give me your thoughts on my concern about consistency of how we flow hard benefits and hard losses through the COPA?
Certainly. Even as far back as the beginning of the COPA, and we had a discussion of the order and the language in there where we were talking of, additional margins created at Basin as a result of non-member sales. Didn't have anything to do with DGC at that time, that were sitting at Basin. They were extraordinary. Not the normal operation, extraordinary. That created a situation at Basin where they had excess margins. So the question is, what's in the best interest of the membership? So we can just recognize these as margins, and you've heard the discussion about capital credits, and in order to get those funds back into members' pockets, then that's a much more time-consuming methodology for getting them to member. And Basin, they set their objectives with regard to their coverages and so forth. So this is truly excess. What's the most expedient way to get that back into the members' hands? Well, it's to do a bill credit. It's not part of the rate. We don't need additional revenue. It's completely separate. It's a unique item. Well, DGC produced dividends and benefits that are over and beyond the normal operation and created a situation where they had excess margins, as would not typically be included in a rate. It's an additional margin. So what's the most expedient way to benefit members? And that would be to put it in a bill credit and get it back to all of the members so that they can disperse it to the end-use consumer. So I do think there's a distinction between and whether you use an embedded or integrated, all of the operations at Basin result in costs to provide service that include all of these components that get put into a rate. All of those items are then subject to the, at least for Powder River, that's the commodity rate that we pay. So, and it's subject to the COPA. The extra items that come up, the extra margins, the additional margins, are really not part of the rate. They're not part of the, and the reason for, you know, it's a, well, don't, shouldn't you treat losses or extraordinary losses the same way you treat dividends? It'd be very difficult to do that. I mean, obviously, if you're looking at collecting everything that you need, and an increase in a one-time charge, typically that's not how rates are designed at the co-ops. You spread it out and put it into the rate. So I think there are some differences with respect to how dividends get treated and how just the normal operation of the co-op is captured in the rates. And so I don't know if that provides any. I do think there's a distinction, but I think that I'm not entirely certain exactly how the COPA mechanism works for investor-owned utilities, but I don't believe that the investor owners are faced with a situation where they have dividends that they're trying to, you know, pass back. It's this relationship as a member of the co-op is unique. It's different.
Well, we do have situations in the IOU, both in Black Hills and Rocky Mountain Power, where there are situations of crediting. And the credit that's associated with that category, credit flows through just like the cost did flow through. So sometimes that COPA mega or the whatever it is, the net power cost or the COPA is a credit on customers' bill because that rate is now a credit going for that next year, for
sure,
that period. But there's consistency between the treatment of benefits and costs for IOUs, in my mind. And I'm just really struggling with why that shouldn't be true for cooperatives.
Yeah, I think the difference is just that they're extraordinary benefits. The dividends are an extraordinary. They're not in the flow of the operation of the system. And it's for the benefit of the member to get it back to the member as expediently as possible.
So the COPA rate is not the only rate by which Precor collects revenue from its customers.
No, certainly not. I mean, obviously we've got our base rates.
So why not pass extraordinary losses through base rates rather than the COPA when it appears that it's not purely commodity related?
Well, I think that, again, the reason for the COPA mechanism was to provide a mechanism by which these changes could be passed on without having to do a rate case. So, you know, if the fundamental question is, are these costs recoverable? And the answer is yes, they're recoverable. Then the question is, do they get recovered in the COPA or just through base rates? For Powder River, since all of these costs are wholesale costs of power, outside the co-op's control, and again, forgive me for the, you know, typically outside the control of the commission, then the ability to recover those costs in a timely manner ensures the financial integrity of the co-op, you know, and that's really the, I think the fundamental reason why there's a COPA mechanism in the first place is just to provide that mechanism and timely. So absent the COPA, you'd have to do what you do for others, which is you do a pass-on application and they come in and they, you know, they have to, you know, do that process every year. But the COPA replaces that process. And so it's I don't want to say six one half dozen of the other, but it has a particular purpose for providing that expedient method for recovery of those costs.
Do you think there's any value in protecting the principle of the COPA or the intention of the COPA?
I'm not sure.
In terms of what's in it.
In terms of what's in it.
Is there any value in having a COPA that's different than just having a rate case? It's important to me that we understand what belongs in a rate case and what belongs in a COPA. And I'm asking you whether you share that distinction or not, or whether when a mid-year rate increase comes, because a rate case is difficult to respond to that, we'll just put it in the COPA.
I think that, like I said, I think the fundamental question is the definition of prudent in terms of power supply. The arrangement and agreement that Powder River has with Basin to provide their wholesale power cost needs is a prudent arrangement. It is. I understand this dilemma. This is it almost requires a legal opinion in terms of whether or not the commission has the jurisdiction to look at the individual components in the wholesale cost. I think you have to be satisfied that the wholesale cost being provided by Basin is prudently incurred. I think we've demonstrated that over the years that we've been putting in the COPA. I don't know that you want to do this every time we have a COPA, but the folks at Basin have kind of stepped up to provide, I believe, a comfort level that there is a due diligence that occurs here. And I think all of those go into your determination as to whether it's prudent. Do I believe that there's going to be a need to get into the various components of the wholesale cost when you do a COPA? I don't believe that that's necessary. And again, to the extent that the commission decides to do that, it would be something different in terms of what they've done before. So, I'm all around that, but that's, I think, the best I can do. I don't pretend to be able to tell the commission what it is that they can or can't do. But the rules are, and the application of this has been such that prudency has not resided on a deep look at the different components in a particular wholesale power provider's cost.
And I want to clarify, I don't even know if I'm at prudency. I don't have any intention of trying to regulate Basin. I understand I don't regulate Basin. I don't have jurisdiction for that. My focus truly is on the interpretation of our rule and whether those costs are commodity related. And again, it's not necessarily for ultimate recovery. It's about whether it fits the commodity cost, whether it's a commodity cost under Rule 26 to be appropriately recovered in the COPA, or whether it's a cost subject to the all requirements contract that's recoverable by Basin from Precor, but in another mechanism, whether it's a rate case or something else.
And I understand that. I guess our position is, with respect to how Powder River sees it, it's definitely a commodity cost for us.
Thank you. So,
why don't we go ahead and take a 15-minute break? We'll reconvene at about 11:30.